You're listening to the Restoration Church Podcast, and guess what? We are finally gathering once again at full capacity at the Lyric Theater, and you can find out everything you need to know at restorationlex.com/this week. You can give, you can fill out a Connect card, find out about safety guidelines, home churches, and follow along on our worship guide, whether you're joining us in person or on the live stream. However or whenever you are joining us, we are so grateful that you are. So let's jump into this week's message. Here we go.
Good to have you. Good to have you online. If you're watching with us online, I know people traveling and with family and stuff. And so we're really grateful you guys have come the day after Christmas. How many of you are in the middle of a sugar crash in the middle right now? You feel the weight of that happening, literally the weight of that happening. I know I am, for sure. We're in that first day after Christmas is always kind of weird because the celebration part of it's over, and then you're trying to figure out, at least my part, what you're going to do with all the stuff that the grandparents got for the kids, where we're going to put all that. And you begin to wind down as if it's over. And as Hannah was saying, the good thing about the church calendar is that there's 12 days of Christmas, just like the song we sing. There's 12 days that we celebrate a feast together, an enjoyment of the season, remembrance of what's happening. And so I love that we can come here the day after Christmas, like she was saying, and just celebrate without the added baggage and stress of what we have going on in our world right now and remember what Jesus has done for us. So we're here in Luke chapter 2. Today, we're getting this tiny glimpse of the space between the birth of Jesus and the adult life of Jesus when he begins his ministry. And outside of this little story we hear have today, there's absolutely nothing that we have about the life of Jesus between the age of 12 and 30. Nothing whatsoever. Think about that. God incarnate, Son of God, the Son of God, chose intentionally to spend the majority of his life in obscurity. Think about what that says about his character. He lived an otherwise normal Jewish child's life, and teenager and young adult, that anyone would during these times. Now, there's all sorts of Gnostic legends and sort of cult religions that come up with ideas about what happened to Jesus during this, but I think the good news is that God did dwell within obscurity, that God did dwell in the middle of the ordinary. I think that's what we see. God makes his home in the ordinary. This story makes that abundantly clear, and that's good news for us who live in the ordinary, who live in the everyday life that we find ourselves in. So our text opens up today. Jesus is 12 years old. Look with me here in Luke chapter 2. Begins like this. It says, every year Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to the festival according to the custom. Now let's pause here for a second, because if you're reading this and you are a Jewish person, especially at that time, you remember that the age of 12 is the age of kind of transition for boys in the Jewish culture. Not only do you begin extensive training in the law and the scriptures, but you begin to learn your family trade as well. You begin to learn what your father has done. So this is Jesus' entrance into the religious and vocational life of the Jews. This is his adulthood beginning, sort of his bar mitzvah, essentially, beginning. So this is his first Passover festival, in a sense, as a man. And you know what it's like when that 10 to 12-year-old boy range, when you tell them they're a man, oh, buddy, you know how crazy that gets. And so Jesus is walking into his first Passover, beginning his steps towards adulthood. And Luke's giving us these details. It's not an accident. This is really important that he's telling us. We'll see why here in a bit. Let's continue reading. It says, after the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. And then they began looking for him among the relatives and friends. And when they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. And after 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. So when his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, and I hope you can hear the tone of Mary in this, "Son, why have you treated us like this?" I'm sure Luke cleaned that language up a bit. "Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." Now, how many of you have watched one of the Home Alone movies in the past few weeks? I dare to say that Mary and Joseph losing Jesus in Jerusalem is a bit even more severe than leaving your son home alone. This is more Home Alone too, because he's in a big city. Now, you might think, how would this happen? How could they have lost their son among these people in that crowd? Well, you gotta understand that in that time, it was common for whole villages, whole families, extended families, to go to the Passover together. So when they're traveling with a crew, a bunch of people. And you know how you assume that your kid's with the other kids? He's playing, you're walking, you're talking, and you're going through the process together. And all of a sudden, you realize, oh, wait, he's not in the crowd with everyone else. And why this is a big deal is that during the Passover festival, there's an estimation that there were 60 to 100,000 people that were in Jerusalem during that time. So imagine trying to find your 12-year-old son, having to walk back a whole day, and then look another day, and then finally on the third day, find your son in the middle of that big crowd. Imagine what you would feel in those moments, the guilt, the panic, how you would feel. And you see a little bit of that in Mary's words of, "Why have you treated us like this?" Those must have been some agonizing days, only to find him sitting with the teachers in the temple. And Jesus responds. He says, "Why were you searching for me?" he asked. "Did you know I had to be about my father's, in my father's house?" They did not understand what he was saying to them. Now, this might be hard for us as modern readers to understand, but this is a moment loaded with meaning when we read this. What happens with Jewish boys at this age? They begin manhood. They begin to learn the law, and they begin to be an apprentice with their father's business. And so when they find him in the temple at the age of 12, what's he doing? He is talking to the teachers of the law. He is learning the law from the very ones who teach it. And he says, "I would be in my father's house." Jesus is essentially saying, "I'm becoming now the apprentice of my father. But not just my father, Joseph. I'm becoming the apprentice of my father in heaven." This is a vocational announcement from Jesus right now. He is declaring his mission and calling. He is not only learning the trade of his father, Joseph, a carpenter. He is learning to apprentice under his father in heaven. We see this in John 5 when he says, "I only do what I see the Father doing." This is a constant thing you see in the Gospels. Jesus working and living from the Father. And this is the announcement of the beginning of that ministry. Mary and Joseph, it says, did not understand, but as time would pass, of course, they would. Here's how it continues. It says, Then they went down to Nazareth with them, and he was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. It's one of those things, treasuring these things in her heart. Have you ever had one of those things happen with your kids where it's not funny right now, but one day it will be funny? It's not a good memory right now, but one day it will be. Luke is writing this in hindsight. I'm sure Mary was not treasuring much in her heart as this happened, but this memory one day would become something so deeply meaningful to her. Just a few sentences here, but this is humanizing Jesus, such a humanizing picture, one of the most humanizing pictures in the Gospels, because for 18 years after this, things are normal. There's nothing else. Jesus lived the average Galilean life, and what astounds me about this text is just how normal this is. Just normal. It's so human. Before this, literally the same chapter, the beginning of this chapter, we get angels appearing, an army of angels declaring glory to God in the highest and peace on earth on whom his favor rests. The next chapter, Jesus is getting baptized in adulthood. We see the Holy Spirit come down like a dove. You literally hear the Father's voice from heaven. And in between all this, we get Jesus getting lost. His mom and dad being upset. We forget that Jesus is thoroughly and completely human. Jesus was human, and not just human. Jesus was human like us. Jesus was human like you and me. Jesus went through puberty. Jesus learned to be a carpenter. Jesus had childhood friends. Jesus laughed and he cried and he dreamed. Jesus scraped his knee. Jesus was human, fully human, in the way that we are fully human. And to dwell on that, I have no words for you today to fully grasp how incredible that is, that God himself was human like us. That's what we celebrate at Christmas. What we celebrate yesterday is the incarnation, that God became man and took on human flesh like us. We often outright ignore that Jesus was human. We love to talk about Jesus being God, and rightfully so. And in some senses, God being all-powerful, Jesus being the fullness of God, is a lot easier to approach. But if we come to see the fullness of Jesus as man, there's ways that, I don't know about you, it's almost harder to approach Jesus in the fullness of his humanity than it is in the fullness of his divinity. The paradox of Jesus Christ, what we see in the scriptures, is at once he is fully God and fully man. The fancy $4 theological term for this is the hypostatic union. Humanity and divinity both in their fullness in Jesus, in which his humanity does not diminish his divinity, and his divinity does not diminish his humanity. It is a beautiful mystery. And my friends, hear me. Mystery in our faith is good. Mystery is good because it calls us to something far beyond us. What we see in Jesus is that he is our way to God, but in his humanity, he is also God's way to us. Fully and completely at the same time. Dorothy Sayers puts it this way. She says, the incarnation means that for whatever reason, God chose to let us fall into a condition of being limited, to suffer, to be subject to sorrows and death. He has nonetheless had the honesty and the courage to take his own medicine. He himself has gone through the whole of the human experience, from the trivial irritations of family life and the cramping restrictions of hard work and lack of money to the worst horrors and pains and humiliation, defeat, despair, and death. He was born in poverty and suffering infinite pain, all for us, and thought it well worth his while. It reminds me of how powerful the words "me too" can be, especially when you are carrying a heavy load, when you are dealing with some sort of burden, and someone is able to step into a conversation with you, step into your world and say, yeah, I've been there, me too, I'm with you, I'm there now, me too. The solidarity of those moments in the same struggle, whether that's losing a parent, and you know what that feels like, or maybe you've struggled with some sort of addiction, and you could step into that and know what it's like. We used to have a lot of guys coming from the Revive House that used to be across the street, this addiction recovery program. And one day, this guy wanders in at the end of the service and is obviously high as a kite, but something is clicking in him. He walks in crying, and he's like, I have to change. And I don't want to do it. I don't know what to do. And I'm saying, literally, we have a recovery program across the street. I will walk you over there. We'll begin this process with you. And he was listening, and he was okay with it, but there was just some sort of disconnect. But then my friend Tom, who is a guy who used to go here, he's moved away. Tom, he was in addiction for 12 years, walks up to this guy, and begins this process of saying a bunch of words that I can't pronounce and know and things about drugs. He's like, yeah, dude, I was on something. And the guy's like, eyes started lighting up in that moment because he saw that this wasn't somebody that just wanted to get him off drugs. He saw someone who had been off of drugs himself. And that solidarity in that moment opened this man up in a way that my words never even could, because he was able to hear me too. I've been there. And this is the heart of God we see in Jesus Christ, that Jesus is the solidarity of God. He is the solidarity of God with us. He's not just sympathy for what we feel. He's not just empathy in feeling it too. What we find in Jesus is compassion. And compassion literally means to suffer with. Not just seeing our suffering. Not even just feeling our suffering. God in Jesus Christ chooses to suffer with us. The book of Hebrews speaks so much to this. Hebrews 4 talks about this a lot. I love what they say about the humanness of Jesus, how the Father He prays to him the same way that we do, and not in some unattainable way. We can understand the humanity of Jesus in connecting this together. Look at Hebrews 2 with me, too. It says, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. So the sin and suffering and death that we carry in our bodies was carried in all of its fullness by Jesus. He felt the weight of our humanity, our pain, in full, not in part. He was not holding back anything, being God and experiencing all of the suffering we felt. He felt every single bit. It continues on in Hebrews 2. It says, for this reason, he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. And I hope you hear these words clearly. God became Jesus, it's telling us, so that he could show mercy from where we actually are, not from where we should be. Not only this, Jesus experienced, it says, every temptation that we do, every single temptation, and this is incredibly to hear, that he experienced every single temptation so he could help us. There is a picture that we have of God sometimes, especially in the salvation process, that Jesus is God's way of finally just putting up with us. That God is just absolutely angry, and Jesus is the one who steps in the way to deal with this God to say, okay, it's not so bad anymore. What we see in the picture of Jesus in this is the character of God being so different from that, stepping into our temptation and suffering, not because he's hardly putting up with us, because he's longing to help us. He's saying this, I stepped into your flesh so I could help you in your time of need as a great high priest. God is longing to lead us through these things, not from afar, but be the God who walks with us as the one who has already been where we are. Hebrews 4 continues, says, therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. And what's our response? The writer of Hebrews continues. These are beautiful words. He says, therefore, let us approach the throne of grace with boldness, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Now, in the ancient world, as you probably can imagine, when you have a king who is sitting on a throne, they're not exactly approachable. They're not exactly someone you can just barge in the door and begin to talk to. No, they're surrounded by guards and servants and soldiers. They're almost always completely unapproachable unless they themselves give you the permission to even be in the room at all. You are not coming anywhere near the throne. Only if you are given permission. And even if you're given permission, you then have to have permission even to speak to the king himself. Knowing that the one in power, the one who is sitting on the throne, has the power to end your life on the spot. And the writer of Hebrews gives us this beautiful picture. That not only do we have the authority to approach the throne of God, but we can approach it with boldness. Now who, think about this, who can approach the throne of the king with boldness? Only sons and daughters. Only family. If you are the king and your son or your daughter barges in through the soldiers and the guards and runs up into your lap, you are not casting them away. They are family. This is the picture that the writer of Hebrews is telling us. When you know who you are, as sons and as daughters of God, you know the type of boldness that you are free to have in the presence of God. I think about my kids. They do not hold back in running towards me. They come with all boldness. And part of that is the confidence in that I will not turn my sons away. They know who they are. They know their father has received and accepted them. And so there is no holding back. They run, they run, they run. So we can see that in our sufferings, in our heartaches, even in the depths of our sin, at our worst, the writer of Hebrews is telling us that we are given not just permission, but freedom to run in boldness into the presence of God, knowing that we are received and accepted. The throne is called grace. The throne is not called judgment. The throne is not called anger. The throne is not called wrath. The throne of the living God is called grace. So we can come. As sons and daughters of God, we have the freedom to be received by the Father. Romans 8 speaks to this. I love this. It says, "For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear. Instead, you received the spirit of adoption by whom we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself testifies together with our spirit that we are God's children. And if children, also heirs, heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ." Thinking back on our story here today in Luke 2, we see the shadow of things that are about to come. Jesus was found in his Father's house so that we might find our place, as he says, in his Father's house. He goes to prepare a place for us. In the temple where sacrifices are made, he would become the sacrifice for us. Among the priests that day who are interceding and making sacrifices on behalf of the people, Jesus would become the high priest that would intercede on our behalf. And on top of that, one day Mary herself would lose her son for 3 days again. She would lose her son only to find him alive in fullness. The one she bore in the pains of childbirth would bear her pain on the cross. I love how the church father Athanasius, he puts this. He says, "He became what we are that we might become what he is." Jesus steps into the mess. Not just the blessing, not just the happiness. Jesus steps into the mess of what we experienced as God with us, Emmanuel, and God for us. Jesus is the solidarity of God with you and for you, right here and right now. He is God's compassion for you in your struggle, in your suffering, in your anxiety, in your depression, in your hurt. Jesus is in solidarity with you today. And so as we receive the elements of communion, I pray for us, whether we're here in person or watching online, that we would come today with a sense of boldness, remembering even at our worst, we have the ability to step into the throne room of grace and receive all that God has done for us as sons and daughters. So, Father, that's our prayer. I know, Lord, that the enemy is, he's called the accuser, because he tells us lies that makes us think that we are separated from you, that we can't come near you at our worst. But Lord, you are called in the scriptures the advocate, the one that speaks on our behalf, the one that...